Hey folks, hello and welcome to a very sniffly episode of Does It Matter?
Yeah, here on Does It Matter this week, both Alex and I are recovering from colds.
Yeah, my blood is more DayQuil than anything else at this point.
I've just been going with NyQuil and dealing with being tired.
I don't think I could do that during the day. I would just be asleep.
Well, I mean, that's the plan, right?
Well, ideally.
Well, this episode is called Circles. And we have some examples of circular media to talk about.
Yeah.
And we're going to get through it. That's the important thing.
Exactly. Not discs, by the way. Although maybe discs, I don't know.
Who knows at this point.
Would you like to go first this week?
Why not? So my first entry for Circles is something that I knew I talked about on the show before, and I was going through my notes. It's like, it's not, I don't have it written down, but I know I talked about it. I talked about it before as like a weekly recommendation.
Okay. Now we're gonna take a deep dive.
Yes. Let's talk about a video game called Mini Metro.
Okay. I seem to recall you mentioning it, I think, if this is the one I'm thinking of.
It probably is. I don't know a lot of Metro-themed casual games. So this was put together by a team called Dinosaur Polo Club, which is a two-man development team, brothers Peter and Robert Curry. They put this game out in 2015 on the computer, in 2016 on smartphones, and in 2018 on the Nintendo Switch.
Nice.
So there's plenty of ways to get to this game. When they made the game, they wanted to develop something that was small scale enough that they could actually finish it, which had been a problem before.
Mm.
And Mini Metro was born when they realized they would need to procedurally generate every level and couldn't spare high production visuals or music. Originally, it was titled Mind the Gap. They released the first iteration of the game at Ludum Dare 26, which is a video game competition. It won an overall prize, I believe 7th place, and 1st place for innovation.
Okay.
Eventually, they ended up hiring an artist, a fellow named Jamie Churchman, to create the visuals, which are modeled entirely after subway maps.
Oh, neat.
So when you, like, create your subway on the screen, it looks exactly like a subway
map. I think this is the one I was thinking of.
For music, they went to an artist who calls himself Disaster Piece, which I really like.
Yeah.
They developed music which would be generated by in-game events and which was actually inspired by the works of Philip Glass. Very minimalist, to be sure. So how did the circles come in? Well, there are two ways. First off, the core strategy of the gameplay is to connect stations which pop up on the map with metro lines. It's really simple, except when it's not. Because each
side of the game.
Yes. Each station is a different shape. Triangles, squares, circles, and then there are rarer shapes that show up later as you play. Stars, pentagons, stuff like that. So similar or smaller shapes appear above each station. Those are passengers indicating where they want to go. So if you're looking at like a circle on the map and there's a couple triangles above it, they're trying to get to a triangle stop.
Okay.
When a train travels along a line, it picks up all the passengers it has room for and carries them to the appropriate stations where they get off. You get a point for everyone who gets delivered to their station correctly.
Do they, like, automatically get off at the next station, or...?
They get off at the next available stop that matches their location.
Okay.
And this is where the simplicity starts to get a little clogged up. Because if you have somebody on one side of the map who's trying to get to a unique stop, like a pentagon, on the other side of the map, they're going to have to take transfers across, like, every line to get there, depending on how you built things.
Okay.
So time passes, and more stations and more passengers appear. Each in-game week, you get to choose a bonus. You get to choose between a new line or more carriages, more tunnels, or interchanges. All of those slightly altering the way that people are affected in your stations. So the game ramps up until your lines are all overrun. The strategy gets deep really quickly. You have to keep diverse stations on a line to keep cars from being overcrowded, which means you also have to be ready to choose the right bonus for the right moment, and you have to try to anticipate what's going to happen next, which can be really difficult because the map zooms out as you play, and it's impossible to tell which direction the map is going to expand in next.
Because, again, procedurally generated.
Exactly.
Okay.
Let's see. This is another place that circles pop up again. You can make lines that run from point A to point B and back again, or you can create a circuit which continuously loops. As your map becomes more and more complicated, it grows increasingly difficult to manage your metro. Since each map is procedurally generated, each game is unique. Their individualization comes from the 20 different maps, which all have realistic geography. Have fun with Cairo's waterways, by the way. And sometimes even changes to train capacity. A few of them only have 4 passenger spots on trains instead of 6 like the rest of them. Also Cairo. Have fun with Cairo is what I'm saying. There's also a challenge mode, endless mode, extreme mode, and an extreme mode, by the way, is really brutal because while you're playing you can like pause the game and erase your tracks and then rebuild from scratch.
Okay.
In extreme mode you're even allowed to like move tracks to include new stops. Like you just have to keep on adding and adding from the end of the last line.
More realistic.
It is more realistic and it's brutal. I don't enjoy extreme mode.
AKA city planning sucks.
Yes. So Mini Metro requires careful planning and a lot of spatial awareness. Much so that you have to mind the circle.
Alright. I remember wanting to play that when you talked about it last time, and like knowing that it's on Switch makes me kind of like want to see about downloading that.
It's such a relaxing game.
Yeah.
I mean, like when you're about to get overrun, you do all of a sudden get like, oh no!
Frantic.
But,
yeah.
It is a really, on the whole, relaxing experience. I suggest switching to night mode. It's like a white background if you're playing during the day, but
Ooh.
It's like a charcoal-colored background if you're playing at night.
Much better.
Yeah. Much easier on the eyes.
Yeah, from a glowing screen a few inches from your face, I bet.
So that's Mini Metro. Check it out, folks.
Okay. Well, my first one is kind of... Well, actually all of mine, I guess, kind of run more with the idea of, like, narrative circle. If you, like, sort of Google that term and try and, like, read about it, you're going to see Alice in Wonderland referenced a lot. I did not do Alice in Wonderland, but the thing I did do is directly inspired by Alice in Wonderland, along with Jean Cocteau, Marcel Proust, and a particular Henry James short story. So it's a weird one. I'm going to try and say it in French. I think it's been established on the show before that my French sucks, but Céline et Julie vont à Bâton, or Céline and Julie go boating, which is a 1974 film by one Jacques Rivette. Jacques Rivette is one of the sort of, he's part of the like French New Wave, Cahiers du Cinéma, like that club, along with Eric Rohmer and François Truffaut and Jean-Luc Godard and like all those guys. In fact, his first film, Paris Belongs to Us, was actually made first before Breathless and The 400 Blows, but would not released until after those two came out. So he kind of got shortchanged a little bit on that one. He's known for the length of his works. At 193 minutes, Céline and Julie is one of the shorter ones of his major films. I believe that the film he made before that, 1971's Out One, in its like original form, I think is the longest narrative film not originally produced for television. I'm pretty sure it holds that record. Not positive.
Oh.
It's just about 13 hours, the full cut. other major works of his include the aforementioned Paris Belongs to Us, which is only about 2.5, by the way, and L'Amour Fou and La Belle Nuisance, both of which were about 4. So, Celine and Julie is probably, like, his most well-known work. It's also really hard to find, which is kind of obnoxious. Like, earlier today I was looking, I was like, I should own this. So, like, went on Amazon, did a whole bunch of Google searches. I cannot find a Region 1 DVD of it. I only saw it because Movie Madness has a VHS copy. But it's very much about, like, magic and the art of storytelling and things like that, and it's kind of divided up into a couple of different sections. So, like, it begins with Julie, played by Dominique Le Boyer, who is a librarian, amateur occult researcher, sitting on a park bench in, I think, in Montmartre, somewhere in Paris, reading a book of magic spells. And Celine, Juliette Bertraud, something like that, walks by, drops a scarf. Julie picks it up to chase after her, and it starts this first section of the film where they're kind of playfully stalking each other, and, like, it's really not clear whether they know each other or not, because, like, on the one hand, the way they're behaving doesn't seem like they do, but on the other hand, like, they are awfully comfortable with each other, and once they... That part kind of concludes, like, they become friends, they start switching identities, they move in together. And then the second section of the story begins where they get obsessed with this particular house, where every time you go in, you're transported back to, like, turn of the last century, like, sort of Edwardian, I guess, post-Victorian, whatever, era where this weird sort of chamber melodrama is playing out, and they keep getting ejected from the house and transported back into 1970s Paris with candy in their mouths. But every time they go in, they see a little bit more of the story, and they get to, like, memorize it and learn about it, and then start, like, making fun of it and interacting with it in weird ways. And the story, which is the part that's based on a Henry James short story, The Other House, from 1896, is supposed to end with, like, the murder of a young girl, and it's about, like, these two women who are, like, vying for the attention of, like, the man of the house, played by Barbet Schroeder, also a major figure in French film at the time. And the two of them eventually disrupt the narrative enough that they pull this girl out of the story and bring her back into 1970s Paris. And it sort of wraps up and concludes, and then the final scene is Celine sitting on a park bench wearing a scarf when Julie walks by and drops a book of magic spells, and Celine picks it up and chases after her. So it kind of does that thing. So there's a title card at the beginning that says, "Usually it began like this." And by the time you've circled back around, there's this idea that this is this endless loop that has iterated who knows how many times. And maybe they know each other and maybe they don't. Like, it's this idea of, like, immersion in an endless story as a metaphor for life. Like, we're searching for meaning, we're searching for authority, we're searching for authorial intervention the way that they do in the house. Like, we experience these things, and through our experience, we learn to reach out and kind of take control. It's also, like, variation within an artwork. We see the same things over and over, but our relationships with them change, which is kind of neat. Like, kind of toys with that idea. The way that, like, Celine and Julie swap identities. I think there's one part where, like, I don't even remember which one. It's been a little while since I've seen it. But, like, one of them has, like, an old lover that's coming into town, and the other one decides to go as her instead and basically tell the guy off. Like, just because we think we know a story doesn't mean we know all of it, and sometimes experiencing it multiple times, we see new things in it. Like, I don't know. Again, I haven't seen it in a little while, so it's hard to talk about, but I remember it being really fascinating and really funny and really weird, And just a couple last little notes about it. Sort of famously, the title has kind of a double meaning, because to go boating is sort of, I don't know if it really has an English equivalent, but it's to be kind of caught up in something, sort of taken in by a story or something like that. And then, the other thing was, it has one of the funniest quotes that I've seen in a while, that I think was one of the photos that I posted on Instagram a few months ago when I watched it. That's like, it's a shot of like one of them on the phone, and the subtitle is, "Go masturbate in the daisies like a Gregorian." So it's an odd one, but it's fun, and if you can find it, I highly recommend it.
I was wondering at what point boating was going to enter your plot synopsis, and it just...
There actually is a literal boat in it,
okay.
Toward the end, so it does fulfill that promise in a sort of roundabout way.
Perfect. Well, I guess...
Yeah, we're kind of breezing through this time, but...
Yeah, well...
It makes sense.
This next one I have a lot to say about.
Okay.
And I don't think you'll be surprised when you find out what I'm talking about. You know, I went 18 episodes without talking about my most favorite band.
Okay.
And it's finally time, kind of.
All right, here we go.
So there is a song called Circles by a band called Electric President. Electric President is... a band that I discovered in 2006, and it just like immediately captivated me, and now my favorite band is a project of the guy from Electric President. His name is Ben Cooper. But let me tell you about Electric President and a little bit about why I wanted to talk about Circles. So to start off with, Electric President was founded in 2003 by Alex Kane and Ben Cooper. They knew each other from living in Jacksonville, Florida, and, they had this crazy productive, like, just urge right away. They recorded 3 albums in the space of 6 months.
Damn.
The first one was titled, self-titled, it's not titled Electric President. It's by Electric President, and it is titled self-titled.
How very coy.
Yes. It came out in 2006. Self-titled is this sort of haunting, seemingly post-apocalypse within society. Songs like 10,000 Lines begin with really bleak lyrics about civilization. We paint the future from this bedroom with lots of progress, cold and heartless, and nothing lives, just twitches and moves. It's all synthetic, but it's all we've got. Yeah. I like sad music, by the way. That's going to become really clear as this goes on. As that album continues, the songs get this sort of fatalistic quality about them. Like the closing lines of a song called Some Crap About the Future. the song goes, and we collapse on a road, on an old dirt road where the sun doesn't feel like such a waste, and we fall asleep under leaves of a couple of the nearby trees, and we never wake again. In 2008, they released their second album, Lots of Time Producing. In between.
Okay.
They released Sleep Well, which is a concept album about fear, and indeed every song is full of imagery and diction which crystallizes that sense of being attacked on all sides. The opening track, called Monsters, provides a good example. It goes, "You called me out, I shrugged you off, I don't have the time to watch you bash in all their skulls. Because there's a new boss in town, his heart is black, and his hands can reach through anything. Stick your head in the ground, you might just dodge the guns."
Hmm.
I remember the first time that I listened to this album, actually, I had gone out for a run at, like, midnight, which is what I did in high school, and just running through the darkened streets and, like, no street lights on, big, like, bushes next to people's driveways, you always think something's around the other corner just listening to this music. Good times. That fear is often combined with societal discomfort that's expressed in the first album, mostly via the sentiment of giving in. Here's some lyrics from the song. It's like a heartbeat, only it isn't. We left the ground, and I floated off and got lost. Now this ain't my home. There's no warmth in these bones. Just a mock-up to help me pretend I'm sleeping. So then in 2009, Electric President moved to German label, More Music. They had been with German label More Music. They moved to an American label called Fake 4 Incorporated. So in 2010, they released their final album to date, although they've been working on another one for a number of years, and it's just very slow going.
Yeah, it sounds like they take their time.
Yes, and it also helps that, Ben is doing his radical face stuff, and Alex is doing his real-life job. So this album that they put out in 2010 is called The Violent Blue, and it includes several songs dealing directly with the ocean. Many of them even kind of sound like they're filtered through water, especially the song The Violent Blue. It preserves a lot of the isolation and oppressive atmosphere of Self-Titled and Sleep Well, but it adds a manner of buoyancy, as in the song Safe and Sound. While the song does include the lines, heard they broke you, that you gave in, that you dropped, and the fight had left you, but don't you worry, makes no difference from the start, your options were all dead ends. So it's got that. But
very cheerful.
It also includes a much more hopeful chorus, which goes, when there's no way out, I'll let you build your home in me till the clocks run down, till your luck's run out. Call me and I will come and fix you, get your feet on the ground. When there's no way out, call me and I will come and bury you all safe and sound. So, like, it's got a little bit of both.
Yeah, no light without the dark, that sort of thing.
To an extent, it sounds as though Electric President is going in circles, singing repetitions of this same cycle of thought and emotion. But there's more to it, suitably in the circles. Start with the first verse here. He says, well, you know where you are, and you know where you've been, but oh my brother, you're lost like me. And I'd offer a hand, but you know that you can't cut any corners when you're going in circles. So we have the singer taking a new sort of tone. He's trying to scare the listener, but, like, scare sense into them. Like Safe and Sound, he's trying to offer condolence, even if it's a shitty situation. Later in the song, you get, now you're home, got dirt on your hands, and oh my brother, you're broke like me. Got lost in the woods, got caught up in scams, got nothing but headaches from all your plans. But I got no answers, and neither did you. Got a rock for a heart now, and you hold a grudge or two. But as soon as you can, just let it all go. Take a word from someone who knows. At this point, the repetition of brother seems more like tough love than mockery, especially given the someone who knows addition at the end. But of course, it wouldn't be a song by Ben Cooper without being more bitter than sweet. Which is why the song ends with an earlier verse repeated, save for one word change. Either way, there's a hole we're digging right beneath our feet. Later in the song becomes, either way, there's a hole we're filling right beneath our feet. We might say that we know what we're doing, but who are we kidding? So it ends up being a circle after all, one in which we try to escape the same old cycle, but are nevertheless swept into it. Electric President has far more than lyrics to offer, but I think these circular lyrics are lovely.
Alright. As a side note, I sat down and like did a fairly close listen of the Radical Face, The Roots. That one, that was really good. I'm interested to kind of plumb the other two a little bit.
Yes, and I've mentioned this before when we did the Epic episode, but...
And several times off mic as well.
Yes. Radical Face did this phenomenal project called The Family Tree, wherein the albums, the roots, the branches, and the leaves all represent generations of a fictional family based on his own over the space of like 150 years.
Yeah, and it's very elaborate. Like, even just from the first one, you can tell that.
Yes. He only uses instruments available in the time periods that he's singing about for each album.
I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, it's subtle enough that you don't notice that there's like not an electric guitar anywhere.
Yeah. Huh. Alright. Well, it's funny because for my second one, I also did a band from Florida, but a very different one. And for this one, like, for the music entry, because, like, there's pretty much always a music entry, I was like, alright, what's an album that starts and ends in the same place, that repeats something at the very beginning, at the very end? And there were a couple that kind of came up. For a while I was going to do, like, Beastie Boys' Paul's Boutique, because that does a loop. But I settled on Antichrist Superstar by Marilyn Manson. Which is an album, if you were alive in the 90s, you probably at least heard of, if not actually heard. But it came out in 1996. It was the second album by second proper album, I guess, by this sort of kind of mainstream industrial metal band, I guess, would be the best description.
Yeah.
Like... later work kind of filtered more into like weird glam rock, and now he's doing like kind of almost a southern gothic thing, which is some of the best work that he's done in years. So I don't know, do your thing, dude, I guess. But the lineup at the time consisted of Brian Warner, also known as Marilyn Manson, Scott Paresky, Daisy Berkowitz, Jordy White, Twiggy Ramirez, Stephen Beer Jr., Madonna Wayne Gacy, and Ken Wilson, Gingerfish. This particular album was produced under the wing of Trent Reznor and another guy whose name is escaping me right now, and I didn't write it down, but he was one of the members of Skinny Puppy.
Okay.
So, you know, it kind of gives you a ballpark of what we're talking about if you didn't already know. I said it was the second proper album. Their first album was called Portrait of the American Family. I did not say that word right. Portrait of the American Family from 1994. And then in 95, they had like a B-side collection sort of thing called Smells Like Children. And that was sort of their breakthrough because that had a cover of The Eurythmics' Sweet Dreams Are Made of This on it. And that was like the first big, like, ooh, who's this spooky guy moment. And then Antichrist Superstar came out, and it was kind of a cultural moment in the 90s because it inspired a lot of pearl clutching. Yeah.
That's such a good way to put it.
And I was thinking about this, and like, for like, maybe I just haven't noticed it as much, but I feel like for kids growing up in like the 2000s and the teens, like, you're not really experiencing that the same way that we did in the 80s and 90s. Like, because mainstream culture is so fractured now, there's not really that sense of like, oh, this thing has arrived and it's ruining the children, let's have a Senate hearing about it. Which they did, by the way. Joe Lieberman kind of got in on this. And like all of the stops on the supporting tour for the album were like protested by Christian groups and shit like that. Like, they were accused of mostly exaggerated claims of drug abuse, animal sacrifice, bestiality, etc., etc. All the usual, you know, satanic panic kind of stuff. And to be fair, the album plays right the fuck into that. That's kind of what it's doing. So it is the first in a conceptual trilogy that is actually backwards, in that... the story arc ends with Antichrist Superstar and begins with 2000's Hollywood in the Valley of the Shadow of Death, with Mechanical Animals in 90 being the middle piece in between. Incidentally, that is the best Marilyn Manson album and the only one that I would say at this point in my life I really like. But I listened to this album a lot as a teenager, so, you know, it has a sort of a place in my, not heart, but spleen, maybe. conceptually, it's kind of built around the Wall slash Tommy slash Ziggy Stardust kind of motif. Of, like, you know, entertainer cum messianic figure rises to power and experiences a fall, except it's a lot darker and more abrasive than that, because the idea here is this figure is more than just, like, a product for our entertainment and consumption. It is an actual being that uses that attention to hoard power and stoke our worst influences and ultimately destroy us. And that's the plot of this thing. It's divided into three segments, and like these three segments are kind of outlined in the album artwork, which is very elaborate and features like a lot of like symbology and crazy shit. Like, I'm remembering the CD booklet, if you like fold it together in a certain way, it forms like different symbols and shit. Like, a lot of time and energy was put into the metaphorical aspect of this thing. So the first section is called The Hierophant. It's tracks 1 through 4, which are, if I remember correctly, Irresponsible Hate Anthem, The Beautiful People, which was the biggest single off the record, Dried Up, Tied Up, The Dead to the World, and Tourniquet, which, again, gives you the sort of flavor that we're dealing with here. The Hierophant is kind of the table-setting part of it. It's, like, introducing this, like, chaotic, dread-filled atmosphere in which this character exists. The middle section, charmingly titled Inauguration of the Worm, is tracks 5 through 11, and it's the accumulation of power. It's, like, this building up. There's, like, a bunch of, like, creepy ritualistic things in it. The chorus of the song, Cryptochid, is prick your finger, it is done, the moon has now eclipsed the sun. Like, that sort of thing. Like, in the creepy, mechanically distorted voice. And then the final section, which is tracks 12 through 16, is called Disintegrator Rising. And that's the, like, okay, now you've put me in this place of power, and now I'm tearing you all down with me. So, the last named track on the album is called Man That You Fear. And it's the longest one. It's about 6.5 minutes, kind of drone into this, like, slow ballady ending that peters out a little bit. And then it does this thing that a lot of albums of the CD era did that we've kind of lost. We didn't have it in the vinyl era, and we've lost it in the streaming era because of its sheer impracticality. But it does that thing where there's 82 tracks of silence for about 4 seconds each, and then track 99 is something. That something is, I think, officially untitled. It has several names depending on where you access the information. Like, I think different streaming services have called it different things. It showed up in different places, but it's not on the album track listing, so it has no official title. The names it's been called is Revolution 99, Empty Sounds of Hate, Ghost Track, and then just untitled. It's these disintegrated vocals that are, like, distorted, and I don't know what the fuck he's saying for most of it, but it builds into this kind of, like, creepy chanting that is repeated at the beginning of Irresponsible Hate Anthem, the first track, which also has this weird thing of, like, this song was recorded live February 14th, 1997. The album came out in 96, you know, doing that. But the quote that both ends and begins the album is, "When you are suffering, know that I have betrayed you." And it's the effect of that circle, I think, is kind of, it puts a nice button on the record, assuming you're going with what it's doing in the first place, where it's this idea that, like, okay, you think it's over. You think we've experienced this thing and it's done and we've survived it and we've passed it, and then it just sort of begins again. And it's a very cynical point, but it makes the whole thing more effective to feel it that way. And I listened to, like, most of the album today when I was writing the notes for this, and, like, just... not to get all political or anything, but just, like, in the current climate, it's like, well, this fits right in. Feels prescient, actually. Fuck. So, I mean, say what you will about it and its redeeming value or lack thereof, but it's definitely doing something cyclical that reflects an actual cycle in the world. So,
how wrong have we gone as a world when, like, Marilyn Manson is prophesying?
I know. Like, I feel weird talking about him because he's such a creepy dude. In, like, a weirdly hypocritical way. In a, like, I'm one of the freaks, stand up against being Blake. Then you listen to him and it's like, no, you're one of the bullies, actually. But doesn't mean that there's not something there either. Nuance exists, I suppose. Which,
sometimes, just technically.
Yeah, I was going to say, again, feels like a weird thing to say in reference to Marilyn Manson,
yes.
But here we are. That said, like, this album is, like, it's very 90s mainstream industrial. Like, it sounds kind of like the harsher, grindier side of, like, Nine Inch Nails and shit like that. Mechanical Animals is still good. It holds up. I've listened to it recently, and, like, it's... I dig it. Anyway. That's all I got.
Well, so my last example... and, you know, before I get into it, I want to say I have an honorable mention this time.
Okay.
I wanted to talk about Dan Harmon's Story Circle.
Mm.
But I've already did Community this season.
Ah.
So let me say honorable mention to Community for being written with the Story Circle in mind. The Story Circle is really fascinating. I have a copy of it right over here. It starts out with establishing a protagonist. Step two is figuring out what's wrong in their life. Step three is they cross a threshold of some sort. Step four, what must be stripped away from them on the road of trials. Number five, meet with the goddess. Number six, meet with the maker. This is the redemption and the atonement.
Okay.
Step seven is return home. And step eight is be the master of both worlds. What do you like learn that allows you to succeed?
Yeah.
Now in your journey, it's an interesting cycle, and it's like derived from studying a whole lot of.
This is a printed out diagram that is actually a circle, by the way.
Yes, it's a circle because when you finish step eight, you're right back at the beginning of who's doing what. Why are they at the center of a story?
Complete with colors and everything. This is cool, though. Like, you've talked about this before. It's an interesting way of parsing out the hero's journey.
Yes. I'm struggling, due to the cough medicine, to remember the person who he based all of... The person who's writing, he did all this based on... Mask, the Hero with a Thousand Masks. Who's the guy who wrote that?
Oh. Yeah, it's not going to come to me right now.
Well, we've got a bunch of nerds at home screaming,
right.
Damn it, it's this person, and we're like,
That reminds me of something for later.
So, that's the honorable mention. What I do want to talk about, which is actually, it's the most circular thing that I know of as far as media goes.
Okay.
Technically, also something I've sort of talked about before, because it's a book by Mark Danielewski, author of House of Leaves.
Ah.
So, this is a book called Only Revolutions. And it was published in 2006.
Oh, yes, this.
The narrative alternates between each side of the book. So, if you read the first page, you're going to get most of a page about Sam. And if you flip it over and you read the first most of a page, you get the same thing, but from Haley's perspective.
Yeah, this is definitely a Daniel Uski book.
Well, we haven't even gotten into, like, how crazy...
talk about, like, taking what E.E. Cummings did to the next level.
Yeah. So their perspectives are presented from opposite sides of the book. Another, here's the thing about the plot, Sam and Haley don't age, they're always 16.
Hmm.
So as perpetual 16-year-olds, they live, the book starts in the Civil War, I want to say, 1863, and carries 100 years forward.
Mm. I see that.
There's a running column throughout the book that presents historical events that occur alongside the narrative, beginning with the Civil War and heading forward.
So there is.
Now, the plot here is that Sam and Haley are attempting to escape the tide of history. They do this by buying, stealing, and otherwise obtaining a series of cars. They travel across the country and across time, as well as across history. Now, the narrative itself is a combination of poetry and stream of consciousness. This is the beginning of the book from Haley's perspective. Samsara, Samara, Grand. I can walk away from anything. Everyone loves the dream, but I kill it. On the other hand, Sam's begins, Halos, Hellscarf, Contraband. I can walk away from anything. Everyone loves the dream, but I kill it. So clearly there's some overlap. I also want to point out that Halo, Hellscarf, Contraband rhymes with Samsara, Samara, Grand.
Hmm.
There's that level of detail going into this.
Yeah.
Now these happen on the first respective pages. Here is the very last line from Haley. Oh, Sam, no, I could never walk away from you. Clearly referencing back circularly to the very first line. Sam's last line is, oh, Haley, no, I could never walk away from you. A double circle. Now, obviously there's a lot of reference between Sam and Haley's perspectives, but the real beauty is in where those perspectives separate, which illustrates their differences. So let's talk about circles. Firstly, the novel's title is Only Revolutions, and each side of the book depicts a close-up of either a green or yellow eye, which is itself circular. There are exactly 360 pages in this book, reflecting 360 degrees in a circle.
Of course there are.
This means the center is at exactly page 180. When you get to page 180, Sam and Haley are closer physically in the books than they ever have been to each other. It's also the arc of their narrative line. They are emotionally closer to each other at page 180 than they are at any other page in the book.
Hmm.
As you separate, they begin to grow apart again. Here's a fun fact. This is very House of Leavesy. Every zero and letter O appear in a different typesetting.
I'm noticing that.
Which, again, highlights the circles. Now, for the big stuff, I can't personally confirm all of this, but I have heard and read some of it, and it's kind of bonkers. Each page contains exactly 360 syllables. Is that not the kind of thing he would do?
It's absolutely the kind of thing he would do. And it's one of the, like, my reaction is... It's so weirdly obsessive that I am both in awe with admiration and intensely frustrated.
Yes.
Also, it appears that, like, page 180 that you mentioned, like, I think the text is the same, just
flipped.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised that, and there's that kind of unification.
Yeah, I think it is.
They're together.
Yeah, they cross the center.
It's a beautiful book as you look at it. Like, the typesetting
yeah.
is clearly something that a lot of time and energy was put into.
Yeah, obsessive much.
Like I mentioned, he also wrote House of Leaves. House of Leaves, if you don't remember it from our, like, very first episode, is an experiment in narrative fiction, which is as daunting as it is thrilling. He's also written The Familiar series, which is a planned 27-book story.
Yeah, that.
Which weaves together 9 narratives from across the globe. There's also the novella 50 Years Sword, which is a ghost told as a children's book using different colored ink to denote the identity of which character is speaking. Daniel Lewski's ambition is not always well received, like in the case of Only Revolutions. Critics called it gimmicky and unsatisfying. But of course, where can you hope to end up when you travel only in a circle? Personally, I don't find it unfulfilling at all.
Yeah. It seems like the kind of thing that you sort of have to be on board with what it's doing when you start.
When you sit down to a Mark Daniel Lewski book, you're not sitting down saying, tell me a great story. You're saying, show me an insane level of craftsmanship put into telling a story.
Yeah.
It's the how and not the what.
The same way you don't go to a Brackage film expecting a popcorn flick.
Right. I mean, like, it's not Avengers Infinity War or whatever. So that's...
Yeah.
If you want to borrow that, by the way...
We have a book borrowed from you, and I try not to double up with that.
That's fair. It's a fascinating book. I had it recommended to me by someone who just, like, basically gave the bullet point list of all of the crazy shit that it does. And it was like, okay, yes. So
yeah.
I bought it.
Duh, I'm going to watch that. Or read that. I say watch that because movies are sort of my thing, but... Okay. So for my last thing, I have sort of a game. You might call it more like an interactive art piece. It's kind of hard to describe, but it's called Every Day the Same Dream. And it was developed by a dude named Paolo Pedersini for Molly Industria as part of the Experimental Gameplay Project, which I looked up, and it's this thing that Carnegie Mellon University does, I think, annually. I'm not exactly sure what the time frame on it is, but it's kind of like a NaNoWriMo kind of thing, where, like, they give, you know, would-be developers 7 days to create an interactive game by themselves based around a theme.
Right.
And this one was created for 2009. I'm not exactly sure what the theme was, but it was then sort of re-released a little bit. You can play it online. If you just Google it, it'll show up. It's a Flash thing with an experimental soundtrack by composer Jesse Stiles, which is actually pretty damn groovy, by the way. And it's a relatively short experience. A very short experience, like when I played it, it took about, I think, maybe 10 minutes or so. So, like, not a huge commitment, but there's sort of a lot packed into that very brief presentation. And, the game features a seemingly infinite loop with very simple controls. So basically, you wake up in your bed, and you have the arrow keys to move back and forth and the space bar, and that's it. And you are kind of an unnamed businessman, and you go, and you, like, put on the clothes from your wardrobe, and you say goodbye to your wife. You go down to the parking garage in your building, get in your car, drive to work, sit at your cubicle, and then the game resets. And you're back waking up, doing the same thing over and over. But when you're in the elevator, there's an old woman there, and she says, 5 more steps and you will be a new person. And the idea is that you have to find different ways to deviate from this pattern. And once you've sort of, like, figured out what one is, then you, when you talk to her again, when you go through the loop again, she says, 4 more steps and you will be a new person. And once you figure out all 5 ways to deviate, you go through the loop one final time where you are the only person in the world. Like, all the other cars on the road are gone, your wife is gone, your boss is gone. And then you sort of witness your own death, and then the whole game resets. Huh. So it's kind of a simple thing, but it's surprisingly powerful in just, like, the kind of the grayscale presentation that it is and some of the, like, little subtle things it does. Like, when you pass by your boss during that, like, sort of scene of it, there's this chart on the wall about, you know, the company's projections, and, like, every time you do something that you're quote-unquote not supposed to do, like,
the company's projections go down a little bit.
Hmm.
Like, little things like that. I don't necessarily want to spoil it, because it is, like, there's not that much to, like, the deviations are kind of fun and interesting. There's a cow in one of them, a homeless guy in another one. Like, the message of it is, like, I mean, it's well-trod territory of this, you know, the cube life is killing the soul, man. Don't be a drone. Like, that kind of thing. And it's kind of, like, both the same and anti, like, the similar sort of idea to, like, what Celine and Julie is, where it's, like, you're caught up in this cycle and you're immersed in it whether you want to or not, and the goal is to, like, take hold of it and take authorship of it. And, you know, maybe change it, maybe you can't change it, but you can at least kind of be yourself within it, which is, you know, the best anybody can do, I guess. But it's also
so true.
Yeah. It's also a really interesting premise for a game.
Yeah.
I kind of like it opened up this whole thing of like what would happen if you expanded upon that? Like, it's essentially the Groundhog Day idea, which is another thing I thought about doing for this show, because that is a circle.
Right.
But, like, what... I've never seen a video game based on that, really. Like, I guess Majora's Mask, kind of. That's the closest I can think of. Which, for anybody not familiar, is a Zelda game where you play the same, like... You end up in this world where, like, a giant moon with a weird angry face on it is about to, like, crash into the planet and destroy everything. And you play the same 3 days over and over again, like, changing little things here and there and, like, learning different things about the pattern that's going on around you in order to stop that from happening. Sort of the closest I can think of. But, like, it feels like there's a lot more design space in there.
Yeah.
And I'd like to see something else like that. So if anybody out there has any recommendations for that kind of thing... I'd be down to learn about that.
Yeah. You know, it occurred to me, I've been listening to a lot of podcasts lately. We don't do, like, any promotion on the show. Like,
yeah.
Not even
we're
the simplest level where we'd be like, hey, this is 18th episode. Like, clearly you've listened to a couple. Maybe this is your first, but, mm-hmm. like... If you enjoyed it, go tell somebody else to listen to it.
Yeah.
We don't even do that.
Insert standard podcast promotion here.
Yeah, I think we take it for granted that if people like us, then they're going to do something about it. But,
yeah.
Like, if you like us, then do something about it, please.
Right. And if this is your first episode, this is kind of what it is. Only usually a little more animated, Dick.
Yeah, we're not sick. This is our first week where either of us was sick. It happened to be both of us.
I know. Synchronicity.
So, and I noticed an interesting thing, actually, a while ago while I was doing my research. I was locked in for my things. I realized I haven't used television or movies for 3 weeks.
No.
Three shows now.
I think this was my first video game in a while.
Yeah. I've been rocking the video game band book setup for like three episodes in a row. So our next episode, I still have three nominations that we haven't used.
Okay.
Story, atmosphere, and sequels.
Hmm. Let's do sequels.
I kind of knew it was going to be sequels.
I'm curious to see where that goes.
Yeah. Okay. So there's that. And also, whatever is interesting this week.
Okay. I do have a couple of those. Before I get to that, I do want to issue an errata that has been bothering me. So, like, a couple episodes ago, when I was talking about The World According to Garp, I was talking about John Irving's novels, and I listed a couple of them, and one of them is actually a John Updike novel. And that happens to me all the time, because they're both, like, mid-century Johns whose last name starts with a vowel and sort of write about a low-key, very dry male suburban angst. So
it's a fair mistake.
Yeah, in my head they're one person, but Robert Runn is Updike, not Irving. So I do know that, internet. But okay, so things to recommend. Top of the list this week is a Netflix series, a limited series by a guy whose name is escaping me at the moment, but I bet you could find it pretty easily. He's the guy who did True Detective Season 1, and I think he's directing a new Bond movie as well. And it's called Maniac.
Yeah, I've been meaning to watch it.
Oh, you should. You'll dig it. It stars hot young talents Jonah Hill and Emma Stone, and also Justin Theroux, and some of the best Sally Field I've ever seen.
I love Justin Theroux.
I know, he shows up in such neat places. Seriously though, some of the best Sally Field I've ever seen. Like, I've always wanted to see her go as balls out as she does here, and it's great.
Right.
The premise is sort of a weird dystopian present, I guess. Like, it's science fiction where it's like kind of our world, but also definitely not our world. Whereby a schizophrenic young man and a woman consumed with guilt enter into a drug trial for a drug that is designed to essentially fix all pain and replace any kind of psychotherapy. And it's even more bonkers and abstract than that sounds. Like, there's a very Wes Anderson-y element to it, particularly in the visual presentation. It gets kind of David Lynch-y in places. The whole thing has this really weird tongue-in-cheek sort of sense of humor. Like, it's a lot to take in, but I strongly recommend it. So that's one. And then the other one is the new Kurt Vile album that just came out.
Oh, yeah.
Which it's late or mid-October. I don't know when people will hear this, but that's when it is now. And it's long as fuck. Like, it's 80 minutes, but it's a very chill, sweet 80 minutes. I listened to it twice today.
Nice.
So, recommending that as well.
Let's see. I am going to recommend The Americans, which I talked with Alex a little bit before we recorded.
Mm-hmm.
Let me briefly say, it is superb drama. It's set in the Cold War with two KGB agents nestled in the United States for over 20 years, and they are just trying to support Mother Russia. What else? I've also been rewatching Arrested Development, and if you haven't seen that, you should get on that.
I need to watch the last season of that.
The new stuff, there's divided opinions on. I like.
It seems way more high concept. At least season 4 was.
It is. Yeah, and watching season 1 is weird because there's like not a lot of concept to it.
It's a network sitcom.
Yeah. Just a really bizarre network sitcom.
Yeah. With so much thought put into every stupid detail.
Yeah. So let's see. I guess those are my two right now. Not a lot new lately. I would recommend the horror film We Are Alone.
Mm-hmm.
Good atmospheric, non-jump-out-and-get-you-horror film.
Always nice.
Yes. That's about it for me.
Alright. Well, I guess that brings us full circle.
Yes, it does.
I think I made that joke last time.
I think I observed that we would probably make it next time, too.
So
and now the circle really is complete.
Circles within circles. yeah, okay.
Well,
so
thanks for listening. Next time we won't be sick.
Yeah, a little more animated and less in a fog.
Yeah, it'll be great.
Yeah. Woo.
All right. Bye.
Okay. Stay tuned for the sequel.